Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, several factors combined to make the last winter's flu season particularly bad in Wisconsin. We'll get a recap of how serious it was and how the state tracks the spread of the illness. First, it's our weekly look at some of the biggest stories in national politics. Someone leaked questions that special counsel Robert Mueller wants to ask President Trump during a sit-down interview. Some House Republicans have drafted impeachment papers for Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, and President Trump has delayed steel and aluminum tariffs on the European Union. You can call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on those issues. Have you looked at the questions that Mueller's team supposedly wants to ask the president? What do you think of them? What do they indicate about where the investigation is going? What questions do you want answered? And do you see reason for the deputy attorney general to be removed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Callum Borchers is a reporter covering the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. Callum, good to have you back with us.
Glad to rejoin you.
So the New York Times published this list. It's questions, supposedly, that special counsel Robert Mueller and his people want to ask President Trump if they get a sit-down interview with him. 49 questions. Before we get to the content of them, there's questions about who leaked these questions. What do we know, if anything?
Well, it's hard to know for sure because this is a leak to the New York Times and not my newspaper, but every indication seems to be that it came from Trump's side and not from the special counsel's office, because the document described to the Times is one generated by Jay Sekulow, one of the president's personal attorneys, who was speaking by phone with attorneys in Robert Mueller's office and jotting down the questions that they wanted to ask the president. And it is that document that ended up in the Times' hands, although they say it came from someone outside of Trump's legal team. So there's virtually no chance that it came from the special counsel's office. It wouldn't make sense for Trump's lawyers to say to the special counsel, hey, here's our list of the questions you already have. What we have here is probably a situation where either Trump's lawyers were just careless with the list, or they facilitated a James Comey-style leak through an intermediary.
And why would the president's legal team want these questions out in the public eye?
Yeah, it's counterintuitive, right? And based on the president's furious reaction, you would sort of wonder that very thing. Why on earth would they want this to get out? But I think one obvious motive could be that they are trying to discourage him from sitting down with Mueller. And keep in mind that the president has repeatedly expressed his desire to do so, and that he feels confident that he could sort of talk his way out of any potential legal trouble. Now, more recently, we have reported that he's soured on the idea of sitting down with Mueller since the FBI raided the office, home, and hotel room of his another personal attorney, Michael Cohen. But still, if you're a member of his legal team and you've been trying to say to him, Mr. President, we really think it's a bad idea to talk to this guy, one way to get it through his head would be to put the questions out there, knowing that they would become a huge topic of discussion on cable news, and particularly Fox News, and then maybe if they haven't been able to get through to him, perhaps somebody like Sean Hannity or Laura Ingraham can, that those folks on TV will be saying, do not talk to Robert Mueller.
49 questions here. They cover a lot of ground. What struck you about the content, the issues covered in these questions?
Well, for one thing, contrary to the president's assertion on Twitter, there are multiple questions related to potential collusion with Russia during the 2016 presidential campaign. So that's number one. I think another thing that really stands out is that there are a lot of questions that seem aimed at determining whether the president obstructed justice. And you see a lot of questions phrased in such a way that they attempt to get at the president's state of mind. What was your intent? And I think that's one of the things that makes the questions potentially dangerous for the president. It's sort of a squishy thing. In other words, the president's legal team has argued that when he's executing his official duties as president, for example, he has the right to fire the director of the FBI. How could that possibly constitute obstruction of justice? But if the answer to the question, what was in your mind when you did that, is, well, I was trying to trip up the Russia investigation by getting Comey out of there, then perhaps it does veer into obstruction territory. And so I think that is one of the things to keep an eye on.
And there's particular questions about what the president intended by comments about former National Security Advisor, former General Flynn. Also questions about President Trump's comments on TV after the Comey firing, referencing Russia and the Russia investigation apparently as a reason for the Comey firing. That's the kind of stuff that the Mueller team might be really interested in.
Well, that's right. And of course, the president seems to have a real knack for phrasing things in a way that is somewhat vague and somewhat open to interpretation and kind of leave room for plausible deniability. And the Flynn example that you mentioned is a terrific point. For example, according to Comey, in his book and in his interviews and his testimony, the way the president phrased that request, as he views it, was, I hope you can see a way to letting this go. Now, Comey has said, I interpreted that as a directive from the President of the United States to drop the FBI's investigation of Michael Flynn. But a different interpretation of those remarks could be that the president was simply expressing his hope that that would be the eventual outcome. And so this is where the intent questions become just so tricky.
Talking to Callum Borchers from the Washington Post, rounding up some of the top news from national politics right now, our weekly news roundup. Before we move on from these questions, Callum, they're all sort of hypothetical because there is no sit-down scheduled between Mueller's team and President Trump. And there's reporting now that the special counsel had floated the idea to the president's legal team. Well, hey, one option, if you don't sit down voluntarily, we can try a subpoena and open some doors that haven't been opened before. What do we know about that?
Yes, as my colleague at The Fix, Aaron Blake, wrote today, it's really clear at this point that Robert Mueller's team is playing hardball here and basically saying one way or another, we are going to talk to the president. You know, sort of saying we can do this the easy way or the hard way. And we kind of saw that in probably the most recent example of a presidential subpoena, of course, was Bill Clinton, who was subpoenaed in the Paula Jones case, but then ultimately the subpoena was withdrawn because the president decided that he would make himself available voluntarily after all. And so that is a possible situation, too. In fact, in the special counsel, the current special counsel, we've seen something similar happen in the sense that a grand jury subpoena was issued to Stephen K. Bannon, the former chief strategist at the White House, and then also withdrawn because he volunteered to sit down on his own.
We'll have more on this story coming up tomorrow. We're planning to look at that at 4:30 tomorrow afternoon. Callum, a related issue, though, Rod Rosenstein, Deputy Attorney General there, maybe subject to impeachment. Some Republicans in the House Freedom Caucus, led by Mark Meadows of North Carolina, drafting a document. Why are they saying they're doing that?
Well, if you look at the articles themselves, they all, or most of them, sort of revolve around a central theme, which is the argument that Rod Rosenstein, as one of the folks who signed off on an application for a FISA warrant in 2016 of a Trump campaign aide, did so improperly. In other words, that he abused the FISA court. This is the very famous or infamous, depending on your view, dossier compiled by Christopher Steele, the former British spy, which was used apparently to some degree to generate the application for that FISA warrant. And as you and your listeners are surely aware, Republicans are absolutely furious about the use of that document to obtain a warrant and to surveil a member of the Trump campaign. And so what you have right now is sort of this split in the Republican caucus. There are members who are drafting these articles of impeachment, but House leadership and the Senate leadership, for that matter, on the Republican side, has consistently said that they think that the special counsel who is overseen by Rosenstein, that those folks ought to be left alone to do their jobs.
Now, speaking of leaks, a draft of those impeachment papers came out yesterday. Here's Rod Rosenstein. He was speaking at an event, I guess, at the museum. He was asked about that.
I just don't have anything to say about documents like that, that nobody has the courage to put their name on and that they leak in that way. But I can tell you, you know, there have been people who have been making threats privately and publicly against me for quite some time. And I think they should understand by now the Department of Justice is not going to be extorted.
So fairly strong words there. Can you talk about his reaction there?
Gee, I wonder who he could be talking about. Yeah, it's pretty... pretty obvious. I mean, this is a guy who appears, at least more recently, to be at peace. And according to our reporting and others, he was initially kind of rattled by the criticism he was getting, particularly from the president, who has called him, conflicted and someone who really should not be in the job. Although he has not moved to fire him, and more recently, though, people around Rosenstein have described him as content and at peace with whatever is going to happen, that he's basically decided I'm just going to do the job as long as I'm in it with as much integrity as I can and just not fret about what may come.
Was he quoting Martin Luther? Was that him? Here I stand, I can do no other? Is he getting ready to be fired,
right,
maybe?
Yeah, exactly.
Talking with Callum Borchers of the Washington Post about some of the top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these leaked questions that the Mueller team would like to ask President Trump in a sit-down if they got one? Possible impeachment of Rod Rosenstein. How about a delay on tariffs against Canada, Mexico, and the European Union? And this Michelle Wolf performance at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. What do you think? Civility? Did this go too far? Is the backlash justified? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our talk with Callum Borchers, reporter for The Fix at The Washington Post, checking in on some of the biggest news from the Capitol. Callum, related to some of what we were talking about earlier, I want to talk about a story you wrote about the National Enquirer. Now, people who shop at grocery stores, including me, have been watching the headlines, very pro-Donald Trump on the front page of the National Enquirer. And this week, Michael Cohen, who had served as Donald Trump's lawyer for years, under federal investigation now, cover read Trump's fixers' secrets and lies. So what does this mean something?
Well, Michael Cohen sure seems to think so. I think what's really striking about this episode was that when CNN asked him earlier this week, do you think that this National Enquirer issue is an attempt to send you a message? And his response was, what do you think? Right, sort of saying, obviously, yes, it is. And the message, of course, is you better stay loyal to the president. Do not flip. And this is, of course, all stemming from the FBI raid that we talked about earlier. He is under federal investigation for possible bank fraud, wire fraud, and campaign finance violations. And one of the concerns presented to the president by his attorneys and some informal advisors is that Michael Cohen knows a lot about you, and he might try to cut a deal to avoid legal jeopardy for himself. He might be willing to turn over damaging information about you, Mr. President. And although Trump has said on Twitter that he doesn't think that is going to happen, it's been pretty hard for the White House to mask his concern. And so this appears, at least in Cohen's mind, to be one effort to keep him quiet.
And can you talk about the connections between President Trump over the years and the leadership at this at the tabloid, the National Enquirer?
Well, David Pecker, who is the publisher of The Enquirer, he's the chief executive of American Media, which is the parent company of The Enquirer. He and the president are personal friends. And if you read closely The Enquirer's most recent statement denying Trump's influence over their publication, it's really what I would call a non-denial denial, in the sense that it's so specific that it leaves a lot of other ways that the president could be influential. So he says, well, the president does not weigh in on editorial decisions. He hasn't asked us to kill stories. He hasn't told us to write specific stories. But, of course, what he told The New Yorker magazine last year was that he paid $150,000 to Karen McDougal, the former Playboy model who claims to have had an affair with Trump in 2006 and 2007, to keep her mouth shut during the campaign about that alleged affair. And his reasoning was, I'm a personal friend, and you cannot be bashing Trump and American media. And The New Yorker's Jeffrey Toobin said to him, well, it's not the same thing. Trump and American media are not the same thing. And Pecker's response was, in my mind, they are. He's a personal friend. And so I think what you see there is this really explicit admission by The Enquirer that they do try to protect Trump, even if they're not getting direct orders from the Oval Office.
I want to bring in a caller now on the latest out of Washington. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. The question I have for your guest is, it seems to me that all the problems with the Justice Department from Comey on down is the fact that everyone thought Hillary was going to win. Everybody knew that she broke the law with her private server, yet they didn't want to prevent her from being president because she inadvertently messed up over her private emails. And conversely, they didn't want Trump and didn't think he was going to win and knew that if she did win, that their jobs would be on the line if they really pressed the issue. Isn't the fact that everyone thought Hillary was going to win the presidency the cause for all that's going on at the Justice Department?
Charlie, thanks for the call. Callum, thoughts?
Well, I think there's a lot of merit to the theory. I mean, you've heard James Comey on his book tour talk about the fact that his actions must have been influenced to some degree by the fact that, as he put it, we were all living in a world in which Hillary Clinton was going to be president. And part of the calculus, seemingly, would be, you know, when he discovered shortly before Election Day that there were emails on this new laptop device. Keep in mind, this was sort of an unrelated investigation. It was Anthony Weiner's sexting investigation that produced a laptop also used by his wife, Huma Abedin, who worked for the Clinton campaign, on which there were additional emails discovered. And Comey says, I had a decision to make. Do I alert Congress to the fact that we are going to be examining new emails, or do I conceal it? And he felt that since Clinton was likely to win, he could envision a scenario in which Clinton wins the presidency. He doesn't disclose the additional emails to Congress until after Election Day. And then Republicans in Congress throw a fit, and they say that he essentially covered for Clinton at the end of the campaign, and that there are years of hearings about that. And that's what he was trying to avoid.
And then what ended up happening is he did acknowledge that they were investigating these emails, and now Clinton supporters and Hillary Clinton herself have pointed to that announcement, saying that might have been enough to tip the balance to Donald Trump.
That's exactly right, and this is why he feels that he was in a no-win situation, and he feels as though there was really no option to do nothing. You know, he would say, and has said in his interviews, that there is sort of this false choice out there, that he had an option to just do nothing. As he says, look, if either way, it's an affirmative action. I can actively conceal these new emails that we are looking into, or I can actively tell Congress about them. But there isn't an option, as he put, there's no door that says do nothing.
Thanks for that call, Charlie. Talking to Callum Borchers from The Washington Post, looking at some of the big stories in national news. Let's quick touch on these tariffs, or at this point, non-tariffs right now, steel and aluminum. President Trump, the White House said, hey, another 30-day extension, another hold. We're not going to impose these tariffs on steel and aluminum for Canada, Mexico, and the European Union, but we're not going to do them eventually. What do we know about that?
Yeah, there seems to be some wiggle room for there to be a permanent exemption there. We didn't get a lot of detail when Sarah Sanders was asked about this at the briefing yesterday. There was no briefing today, but she basically said, I'm not going to have any announcement, but that negotiations with those countries are ongoing. I think it's also interesting, though, to point out that, as Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, said the other day, that if the United States is going to impose these tariffs, it really needs to do so quickly, because otherwise they will lose their effectiveness. In other words, he seems to be concerned that another country that has a permanent exemption, say South Korea, could become kind of a way station for steel from other countries that are subject to the tariff, right? So, I mean, if you're China, for example, and you know, well, if I ship the steel directly to the U.S., I'm going to get whacked with this big tariff. Maybe I can just send it to South Korea first and then have the shipment come from South Korea, and that's a way to work around it. And I think that's what Ross is talking about, trying to avoid people gaming the system, as he put it.
And Callum, I want to take our last few minutes and look at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. This thing happens every year. Usually the president's there. President Trump has opted out of going to these things. And comedian Michelle Wolf was brought in, as comedians are, to roast the president and the administration and the media sometimes. People, a lot of backlash on this one. People unhappy with what she had to say. What is getting people's attention on this one?
Well, probably the biggest criticism has centered on the way that she went after Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary. And there is some disagreement about what her intent was. A lot of the criticism centers on the impression that she was making fun of Sanders' physical appearance at times. She has said no, that was not her intent. But she did say that she liked Sarah Huckabee Sanders as Aunt Lydia in The Handmaid's Tale. That was one of her jokes. And one way to look at that is, well, she was just talking about being a sort of mean-spirited person and someone who is unhelpful to the cause of feminism. Another way to look at it is to also say, yeah, but the whole package is she was comparing her to an unflattering figure on TV. And she also did make a reference to Sarah Huckabee Sanders' perfect smoky eye, as she put it. She did say that it was perfect. But again, I think people are wondering, why are you talking about the press secretary's physical appearance at all?
How did this one compare to roasts at past events, at the past annual events?
Well, that's a good question. And I looked back at that this week. And, you know, humor is subjective, I suppose, but it seems to me that there has been a lot of pointed, personal, and cutting jokes over the years at this dinner. And what's different, unquestionably, is the atmosphere in Washington around this particular president, who, as you said, has not gone to the last two correspondence dinners, even though other presidents have. And I think what's different about it is that while other presidents didn't really like going and didn't always find the jokes funny, they sort of decided to just grin and bear it and put up with it. And this president does not. He does not bear it. And in fact, he has decided to weaponize the jokes at the White House correspondence dinner and use it to discredit the media or look like make the media out to be his enemy and to be biased. And I think that is something that is different. I mean, all presidents complain about their coverage to some degree, but it seems to me that the White House Correspondents Association can't get away with what it used to get away with, because we have a president right now who will take every example he possibly can, even if it's from a non-journalist, even if it's from a comedian, will gladly take that material and say, see, this proves that the media is just out to get me and they hate me and they can't possibly be fair.
It's always been a weird event in a way, because in theory, the White House correspondents are holding the White House accountable. It's kind of an adversarial relationship. They don't want to appear too cozy laughing along together. Also, the subject of the roast is the sitting president having to put up with whatever the comedian is saying. Is there talk of just ending this event or changing the format or something?
There's some of both, yeah. I think that the latter is probably more likely. You have had folks call for a total end to the event altogether. There's no indication from the association that that is a possible route, but you did see Margaret Tolliff, who is the current president, say that she and Olivier Knox, who is the incoming president, they are going to hear from members about what they think the format should look like going down the line. So that could mean losing the roast element. Keep in mind that most of the dinner is devoted to handing out awards and scholarships. It's just that that's the stuff that's, you know, sort of insidery and boring, and we don't watch that part on TV. So it could just be a totally different event. And frankly, it has changed a little bit in recent years anyway. We've seen less of a Hollywood presence.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Callum Borchers from The Washington Post and our weekly look at national politics. Coming up, the numbers on a tough flu season in Wisconsin. This is Central Time. Even if you managed to avoid the flu this year, you probably know someone or several someones who had it. It felt like a tough flu season here in the state, but do the numbers really back that up? Our colleagues at WisContext tracked the course of this year's flu season. Associate Editor Scott Gordon joins us now to take a look back. Scott, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
It felt like, to the untrained eye, well, my untrained eye, like a big flu season. What do the numbers show us? Was it as bad as people like me thought it was?
It was a rough flu season. It wasn't a pandemic, but what sort of happened was something that was kind of like the seasonal, you know, flare-up that one typically sees, although people will who study this professionally will caution you that there's no such thing as a typical flu season. But it was kind of like that seasonal curve you'd expect to see, but just more so and more intense. And with the H3N2 strain in the mix, which is a little more aggressive, you know, you had more people in the hospital and things like that. So, yes, overall, tougher than usual.
Now, you use the word pandemic, and that has a technical definition. I don't know if everybody in the field will agree exactly what constitutes a pandemic, but roughly, what would that mean?
I mean, that would be something far more out of the ordinary, where you'd see more of a global impact and, you know, more deaths and, you know, something that's much more of a departure from what you see in a seasonal kind of sense. This was definitely a tough season. I think everyone agrees on that, you know, for North America and for Wisconsin, but not quite a pandemic. People were kind of worried at a certain point that it could get to that level.
And 2009 was our last pandemic, according to the experts you talked to. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And that was a pretty bad year.
Yes, it was.
And but some of the experts you talked to said this year, this last season, this flu season was proof that even if it isn't a pandemic, it can be bad.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's a lot of hospitalizations that happened, as I said. And, you know, when you see kind of the chart of, you know, flu cases get to that high peak and kind of stay there relatively longer and take a while to drop off from it. I mean, that represents obviously lots of people getting sick, but also going to the hospital and, you know, the pressures being placed on the healthcare system are considerable, especially over the past year where healthcare providers across the country have been dealing with shortages of things like IV bags, which, you know, are pretty crucial and you know, common in taking care of anybody who's hospitalized. And, you know, again, with the H3N2 strain, it tends to just be harder on people in general. You know, even people who are vaccinated are more likely to get sick if it's a more aggressive virus.
And as I understand it, as the main type of flu we had was finally leveling off, there was worry that another one was picking up. It never quite, it didn't turn down that downward slide, but it extended the season longer than it might have gone.
Right. For some reason, influenza A tends to predominate early in flu seasons, and then later on, influenza B will kind of take up and be a greater proportion of the cases. In this case, it did definitely kind of seem to prolong the season, but it didn't negate the drop off in influenza A as that was happening.
And an interesting thing you wrote about is that we think of flu season, and justifiably so. It's when we have lots of flu. There's never a season where there's zero flu.
Right. If you talk to the folks at the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene, who sort of pull in testing and data from across the state to track influenza and all kinds of other diseases, they'll point out that, you know, usually in a typical week, in any time of year outside of flu season, they'll still see at least a couple of cases per week. So we're not always in that phase where there's a ton of flu going around and a whole lot of danger of contagion. But where we are right now is as things are dropping off, there is still kind of enough of it out there to create dangers of contagion, and where public health officials are still kind of really hammering on these messages of get vaccinated, don't go to work if you're sick, don't take your sick kid to a nursing home to see the grandparents and things like that. So there's it's a drop off, but not quite out of the woods, even though it's what most of us would think of as flu season being over.
Scott Gordon is with us from WisContext. We're talking about this year's flu season, a pretty bad one, not one of the worst ones, but a pretty bad one. And Scott, I've learned recently in your reporting and in some conversations we've had here on Central Time, Wisconsin plays a big role in flu monitoring for the whole country. And also, it sounds like we do a lot of monitoring, maybe more so than most states here in Wisconsin, to watch for signs of flu. Is that right?
Right. What's interesting about the state lab here in Madison, the State Laboratory of Hygiene, is obviously they're doing a lot of scientific testing and a lot of data crunching. But one thing that the folks there really emphasize when I talk to them is that they have to work really hard to kind of keep up this communication network with public health labs and clinical labs around the state to really make sure they're pulling in as much data as possible and that people around the state have the resources they need to gather samples, you know, to ship them out to Madison and things like that. And then going on from there, the state lab contracts with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and helps in kind of the, you know, middle America region, basically, in terms of national flu surveillance. So to some extent, scientists in Wisconsin are also pulling together data from other states in the region to help create, you know, this bigger regional and national picture of what's going on that, you know, ideally helps people respond to flu season, helps people get health resources where they need to be, and, you know, informs what people need to do as far as care and as far as, prevention.
This is a lot of data they're dealing with because it's when and where flu happens, who it's happening to, their age, hospitalization, treatment. If they've come to the doctor, I guess they wouldn't be detected if they didn't. You're a data guy. This sounds like a lot to juggle.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm a data guy to the extent that the folks there are. But yeah, it is really interesting. And, you know, again, like I said, it kind of hammers home the very human work that goes into making sure that all that comes together. You know, the other thing is that it's a resource intensive thing, and the federal funding that comes to the state lab as part of this CDC agreement is kind of what enables them to ramp up when flu season gets really intense, and to have the equipment they need to do a lot of testing, and to have, you know, staff who can kind of jump on it. So, you know, if that federal funding were to go away, we wouldn't necessarily have the same ability to, you know, help surveil the flu, especially, you know, flu from other states. It's not something that people think, you know, state funding is likely to make up for.
You also talked to some experts about big picture flu prediction, and these people are looking around the globe. They're looking at, you know, what's happening in India right now, what's happening in Australia, Europe, whatever, trying to figure out what kinds of flu, how bad they are, and ultimately, I guess, trying to figure out, so what do we need a vaccine against? Can you talk about the scope of that effort a little?
Right. I mean, it's a little different everywhere. I mean, what we saw in Wisconsin this year was very much in line with what was happening nationally. But, you know, I've had it pointed out to me in my story, a scholar that I talked with at the email with at the University of New South Wales mentioned that, you know, in India, there's still a lot of problems with the H1N1 strain that made the, you know, 2009 pandemic so bad. Great Britain got hit really hard. Mainland Europe, not so much. I'm afraid I don't have a ton of information about other parts of the world, and that's obviously not the whole world. But yeah, it's something where there's always variations, and you know, again, epidemiologists are always kind of careful to stress, like, there's not necessarily a typical flu season. There's just these kind of familiar seasonal curves that, you know, sort of hold up from year to year.
A couple of the people you talked to referred back to what I imagine is a lurking fear for people who researched the flu 100 years ago. This is 1918, this horrific flu influenza outbreak killed more people, I think people say, than World War I. So that worries me. But some of the experts you talked to said there's some good news in terms of how we're prepared for something like that.
Right. I mean, what people have said is that at least we know more about viruses and how to prevent contagion and, you know, what to do than we did 100 years ago. And I think there is still a lingering fear of, you know, novel strains of the virus that can, you know, do a lot more damage to people emerging. And there's also a lot of fears about whether the way that we prepare vaccines is adequate and whether it's always going to provide the defenses that people need. You know, but people will also point out that even a vaccine that's not perfect, that doesn't completely prevent you from getting sick, could, you know, lessen the severity of what you go through, lessen the burden that you end up putting on the healthcare system if you do get sick.
And finally, Scott, you talked to Wisconsin experts. They're dusting off their hands after a rough flu season. Now, are they already starting to think about 2018, 2019?
Well, to be honest, I'm not sure. And I don't know if they necessarily are dusting off their hands quite yet, because they're still keeping an eye on it. And things are, like I said, it's what people generally think of it being over. But, you know, it's still kind of tapering off a bit.
We'll leave it there. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Scott Gordon is the associate editor of wiscontext.org. You can find his most recent article on the flu season and all of their work on the topic by going to wiscontext.org and searching for flu. First, if I were to ask you who wears makeup, you're probably going to say women. For years, cosmetics have been largely marketed and sold to women. Men, on the whole, apart from maybe actors and TV anchors, have not made up a big portion of the makeup customer world. But there has been a recent slow shift on that front. Men are now turning to makeup such as concealer, foundation, and more to hide acne, small blemishes, even out skin tone. And a YouTube search for makeup for men brings up millions of videos. Many of them are makeup tutorials. A lot of the videos advise men on how to create a subtle no-makeup look with makeup. Our next guest took a look at what's driving this change and tried it out for himself. Jacob Gallagher is the men's fashion editor at Off Duty for the Wall Street Journal, where he writes a weekly column on style trends. His recent piece is titled, "More Men Are Wearing Makeup Than You Think, Here's Why." Jacob, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. Well, why did you start to tackle this issue? Men apparently wearing makeup a little more than they used to.
Yeah, where it really came from was this idea of how men's grooming, in the general category, has really taken off over the past decade or so. So we were looking at harder data there that men now make up, I believe, somewhere around 20 to 25% of the broader grooming market. And that's something that has been talked about for quite some time. You know, you see specialized, you know, body washes or, you know, specialized shaving products for men. And that's really fueling a big part of the cosmetics market right now overall. So what we started to look at was this idea of more men wearing makeup. And I'm glad that you mentioned YouTube tutorials, because that is really, particularly on the internet, where this is like really the most, you know, prominent and is happening in the most public manner. So what I really wanted to look at was that those examples, as well as, you know, CoverGirl announced their first male spokesman. There's been a few instances of, you know, makeup brands claiming, so to speak, a male celebrity wearing their products. So what I wanted to look at was, is this more than a, you know, kind of more extreme trend? You know, if you look at makeup tutorials of men wearing makeup on YouTube, they tend to be things that are definitely more, you know, intensive, I would say. So I started looking at if men were wearing makeup, you know, in a more, you know, everyday manner, so to speak. And the answer was, some certainly are, and you know, it's definitely not the level of investment. It's definitely not the amount of products as women put forth on makeup. But you know, some men were definitely getting a lot more involved in it. And it was curious coming out of it. It does seem to be a market that, you know, more cosmetics brands are gonna put some money behind to see if it could be a viable business, because it is a pretty big untapped market if you can convince men to do it.
And that's the key there. This is, I mean, I could see a moisturizer, lotion, hair care product, mm-hmm. whatever. Makeup is kind of the final frontier for dudes.
Yes, it is. It is. And I think that, you know, rightfully so. I mean, as for the story, I did, you know, wear makeup for a week. It was all very subtle. You know, I believe I mentioned in the story, like, my coworkers did not even notice, and they knew that I was doing this story. But it did have somewhat of an effect that I thought, maybe this is something that I could do. And I do think that there is probably going to be more men that pick up on that. But it's going to be something that I think for men is always going to be about that internal struggle. Can you get over the stigma? Can you just get over the sense of, oh, I am wearing makeup? That is a pretty big hurdle to get over. I'm fully aware of that. I don't think that, you know, it's going to be something that will ever be as popular as it is for women. But could I see it getting, you know, 5% bigger, 10% bigger, maybe even 20% bigger over the next few years? Absolutely. I mean, I think we're looking at the way that society is changing. We're looking at the way that society is thinking about their appearance in different ways. You know, I think men certainly care a lot more about clothing than they used to. You know, maybe that could happen with makeup. It's just all kind of a great unknown right now.
And it sounds like, for at least some of the men you talk to and people in the industry, if men are wearing makeup, for the most part, it's, I'm wearing makeup maybe to conceal something. I don't want to look like I'm wearing makeup.
Yeah, I mean, there was one makeup artist I had spoken to in particular, and she was saying, like, you know, it's crazy that for men, if they have a blemish or if they have acne or something like that, they can't really reach for makeup. They can't go for it. So that I found curious, because it is this kind of, you know, tool that, you know, it could be at your disposal if you so want it. So I think that might be, you know, kind of the easiest entry point, so to speak. That was the experience that a lot of guys I spoke with had, is that if they felt like they had something that was amiss with their skin that day, that they might reach for, you know, a little bit of foundation or a little bit of concealer.
Talking to Jacob Gallagher from the Wall Street Journal, talking about a modest increase in men wearing makeup, usually more to conceal than to enhance, it sounds like. Jacob, you mentioned you put this to the test yourself, and you said it was, you wrote that it was very different to have someone else put on makeup or teach you how to do it, and then when you took the training wheels off and tried doing it yourself.
Yeah, it definitely was something that felt very unfamiliar, I would say. It wasn't it was definitely not something that in my lifetime anyone had ever taught me how to do. And that was something that a lot of guys I spoke with returned to again and again. It was something that they really had to learn and kind of figure out once they started. You know, one guy I spoke with, I don't know if it made the story or not. I don't believe it did. The first time he put, you know, makeup on, it got all over his shirt collar. It was a total mess. And he was saying that it took him some time to learn and figure it out. And it is that real trial by fire kind of thing.
And was it weird? I mean, did you kind of feel the stigma of it as you were trying to put the makeup on yourself? Like, I don't know if this is right.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, by the third day, I was kind of used to it and I wasn't thinking much of it. But it took knowing that no one could really tell, so to speak. I think on that first day, I went into a meeting and I thought, is someone going to notice that I'm wearing this? Of course, no one did. And if they did, I don't think they would have said anything. I think that I kept coming back to the fact that even if someone noticed, I don't think they would have asked because it is kind of such an alien concept. But yeah.
And you said actually when you pointed it out to people, you got some pretty good remarks, right? They thought it looked pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, they thought that it looked, you know, I hate to use the term normal. I guess that the answer would be average. It looked, you know, kind of average. And that, you know, I think one friend said I had a slight glow once she realized what I was wearing, but that was the extent of it. I think personally I did feel a little bit better. My skin looked a little bit smoother. But yeah, I don't know exactly how much of a difference it really made. I can tell you, once the article was over, I don't wear anything anymore. I did not continue to wear makeup after the article was over. I have once since I had a blemish on my face in the week after, but that was about it. Yeah.
Now let's get back to the idea of marketing these products, makeup products in particular, to men. Is there going to have to be something like we see with a lot of products where, okay, we got to get guys over this idea. This has to be like extreme sports branded guy marketing material to get men to take the plunge here.
I think so. I think that, you know, it's funny because I was trying to think of how it would be marketed, and it's a difficult thing because you can't really have any sort of extreme thing. It kind of has to be the most simplistic marketing possible. It has to really be very I would say situational almost. And that's hard because that doesn't make for an easy marketing campaign, especially in the world of cosmetics, where if you look at how women's cosmetics are marketed and women's makeup is marketed, it's incredibly flashy and very splashy and very image-based, whereas I think for guys, it's more of a problem-solving type of thing. So I'm fortunately not a marketing executive that has to make those decisions, but I think it would be a harder sell in that regard.
Now, reader comments on your piece ran the gamut from this isn't a big deal, who cares, to men shouldn't wear makeup, you know, at all. Is there always going to be that substantial percentage of men for whom this is a non-starter?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I get those comments on a lot of stories that I write, whether about clothing or whether about makeup or what have you. I think that men have different interpretations of how much they should care about appearance in any capacity. And, you know, we're not a fashion publication. We're a broad reaching, you know, newspaper. So I think that some men do have a different feeling about what is quote unquote right or what is quote unquote what a man should do. So I think that there will always be those people. I think there will always be people that have a feeling that you should, you know, rub dirt on your face and only ever wear coveralls. You know, I think that it's just people have their different perceptions. I think that there will always be people that have a stigma around it. But I also think that to care that much about someone doing it, that's what I found that was really interesting, was that a lot of guys that I spoke with that did wear makeup, it didn't seem to be that big of a deal to them. And I always find that interesting, where when people think like, oh, you care so much about your appearance, or you care so much about, you know, what your face looks like to the point that you're wearing makeup, it's not so much about that. The people that seem to comment seem to care a lot more or be a lot more passionate about the topic. It's just that it was something that they did, you know. So it is interesting. I think that it's also a big generational thing. I'll be totally upfront that a lot of people that I spoke with were much younger. I think that for an older generation, it's a harder thing to wrap your head around, and that's perfectly understandable.
And we have to leave it there. Jacob, thanks for joining us. That's Jacob Gallagher, men's fashion editor at Off Duty for the Wall Street Journal. He joined us to talk about his recent article looking at why more men, a slowly growing number of men, are wearing various kinds of makeup. Let us know what you think. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Has this ever happened to you? You're talking to a person, you know, like people do, they talk, and you are talking about movies, and you admit you haven't seen movie X, and you get the reaction, what? I can't believe you haven't seen that movie. What's wrong with you? We've all been there, I think. We all have those movies, the must-see movies that we haven't gotten around to seeing yet. Well, Bill Martins is here with us now. We were talking about this earlier in the offices here. We'll probably do a segment on this later. But we were talking about our must-see movies that we haven't seen. You've got a lot of them, Bill.
It's a very long list, yeah. I mean, we were talking in the office about The Matrix. Haven't seen it.
That's amazing to me.
Yeah, I don't...
Nothing personal.
Yeah, and Shawshank Redemption was another one came up.
That's one I haven't seen, and I've been scolded for that by former producer Amanda Magnus. That's her favorite movie of all time.
Yeah.
And she's just appalled that anybody has never seen that.
So I haven't seen all that many movies, but the ones I have seen, I've seen 6 million times.
Right.
I mean, you Home Alone, Home Alone 2, I could probably recite that whole movie.
Right.
Strange Brew...
with Bob and Doug McKenzie.
Right. Uncle Buck.
With John Candy.
Elf. Major League. I mean, these are classics. They're right up there with Citizen Kane, right?
Which have you seen?
No, I haven't,
Me neither.
I probably shouldn't
Me
say
neither.
That.
Yeah, so we've got a lot of deficiencies. Also, your canon of must rewatch movies is a little weird. No, nothing personal,
it's
Bill.
It's very niche.
Yes.
If that's the right word.
But hey, you enjoy it.
I do.
Keeps
me out of trouble.
We'll talk more about this in the future. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR with a movie you haven't seen that people give you a hard time over. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.